This week, we're in Romans chapter 13. Are you a good citizen of Canada? The highest honor you can get in this country for being a good citizen is to be recognized as a companion of the Order of Canada. This is what the Governor General's website says. The Order of Canada is how our country honors people who make extraordinary contributions to the nation. Since its creation in 1967, Canada's centennial year, more than 7,000 people from all sectors of society have been invested into the order. The contributions of these trailblazers are varied, yet they have all enriched the lives of others and made a difference to this country. Their grit and passion inspire us, teach us, and show us the way forward. They amplify the order's motto, something in Latin that means they desire a better country. And then it goes on to tell us how to nominate someone. At the end of last year, there were 5 new companions. Stephen Harper, the last prime minister, was made one. A lawyer who was our ambassador to the U.S. in the 90s was another. And then James Cameron, who found the Titanic and then made a blockbuster movie about the disaster, was another. I don't know anything about these people and what they're like as human beings, but some committee thought them worthy, and here they are. So how do you think your desire for a better Canada compares to theirs? How does the way you wear your Canadian flag stack up to the way they do? We're in Romans chapter 13, where Paul turns his attention to their Roman citizenship. Because in a way, all Christians have dual citizenship. We are simultaneously citizens of God's kingdom and citizens of some country like Canada. Romans is a letter Paul writes to the Christians in Rome because there are some ethnic tensions. And Paul is trying to inspire them to heal their relationship the way Jesus deals with conflicts between people, rather than the way empire deals with conflicts. Because the gospel is about how God is setting up his kingdom on earth as an alternative, parallel civilization to the Roman Empire. In God's kingdom, everybody matters, not just the rich and powerful, and everybody cares about not just their own well-being, but use the power of choice to make choices that are both good for the person and the greater good. Jesus' gospel doesn't just reconnect God to people that he created. Jesus as our king also shows us how to love and get along. So the truth of everything Jesus teaches, in the end, shows up tangibly as the way Christians get along in relationships, both in the church and with people outside the church. The famous Christian apologist Francis Schaeffer writes, quote, "Our relationship with each other is the criterion the world uses to judge whether our message is truthful. If we do not show love one to another, the world has a right to question whether Christianity is true," unquote. So we live in a kind of parallel civilization. We have our relationships out inside the church, but Christians also rub shoulders with people who are not Christians in our everyday life as we go about working, shopping, and living. Our dual citizenship, both in the kingdom and some country, can get complicated, because there will be times when our duty to each citizenship may come into conflict. For example, as Mennonites, we don't believe there's such a thing as a just war. One of our core convictions from getting to know Jesus is that all wars are bad, and wars are not ways to solve problems. So it has happened in the past, when Mennonites are drafted into the army during wartime, and that created a problem. Do you go against your conscience to fight for your country, or do you go against your country and risk the punishment for breaking the law. So far, Mennonites have always been able to negotiate something with governments so they could be in the army but not required to do combat duty. But it doesn't always work out so nicely. Some of the Christians living in Hitler's Germany had to make some tough choices about speaking out against what they saw the government doing around them. And in times like those, we may question what Paul means by what he's telling us here. Sometimes the conflict in our loyalty to God and country is just not resolvable. This conflict of loyalty is why some countries don't allow for dual citizenships, like Singapore. There was a guy in my church from Singapore who married a Canadian girl, and before he could apply for Canadian citizenship, he had to write the Singapore government and ask for permission to relinquish his Singaporean birthright. So what Paul gets us thinking about now, if we are Christian, is how we manage the tension between our dual citizenships. What he says invites us to think about the common values and vision between this country and God's kingdom, and also where they diverge and conflict. Is there a way to love God's kingdom and desire for our country to do well at the same time, as Paul suggests? Does God's vision for his kingdom overlap with our vision for Canada, glorious and free? In Paul's time, the dual citizenship that Christians had to navigate was between empire and God's kingdom, and I think that divide then was very wide. Empire was very violent, very elitist, and very oppressive, as I've been going on about. And what Paul now gets to in chapter 13 is some thoughts about how to live out their dual citizenship in empire. And I think I can pretty much sum up what he says as, live to love for another day. Here's chapter 13. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there's no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, whoever rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted, and those who do so will bring judgment on themselves. Verse 5. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities, not only because of possible punishment, but also as a matter of conscience. This is also why you pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. Give to everyone what you owe them. If you owe taxes, pay taxes. If revenue, then revenue. If respect, then respect. If honor, then honor. Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For whoever loves others has fulfilled the law. The commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other command there may be are summed up in this one command. Love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Verse 13, let us behave decently, as in the daytime, not in carousing and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and debauchery, not in dissensions and jealousy. Rather, clothe yourself with the Lord Jesus Christ and do not think about how to gratify the desires of the flesh. About 500 years before Jesus, in the early days of Rome, before it became an empire, there was a farmer who was drafted into the army and had to leave his farm to go fight a war for the empire. When he came home from war, he was shocked to discover that some rich person had laid claim on his land while he was away. That rich person took away his livelihood and basically his whole life. The farmer became broke. He owed money he had no way to repay, and he thought the system was unfair. So in frustration, he decided to go to the public square to openly voice his complaint. He made a passionate speech that rallied the peasants to go on strike, and that forced the government to make some major reforms about the rights of the working class. The farmer was able to effect change, but, however, not before he was arrested and sent to the dungeon and he was tortured to within an inch of his life. What we learn from his story is that Rome, especially since becoming an empire, is not a system where ordinary people can easily make change. A person literally risks losing his life if he speaks out against the emperor. And this, I think, is what we have to remember as we try and understand Paul's comment about the dual citizenship. That empire is not a system where people have a voice. It's the city hall you can't fight, as they say. So they would be foolish to oppose the system overtly. They would get nowhere, and it would certainly lead to a world with no Christians left. And so, instead, I think Paul is urging them to shift focus. Instead of trying to change what is not changeable, he tells them to live their faith in a way that focuses on doing the things God tells them to, like loving and blessing people, and don't get themselves killed. Now, what we know is that eventually even that didn't work. Eventually, Christians would be punished and killed for no reason other than that they were Christians. For now, Paul's strategy is basically twofold. One, he tells them not to give the empire any excuse to kill or jail Christians and sideline them from their mission to love and bless. And two, he tells them to live as good citizens of Rome so they don't give God a bad name and give people any reason to dismiss them as snake oil salesmen when they talk about Jesus. So Paul says, pay your taxes, cooperate with the authorities as they do the job of governing, treat people with proper respect and honor. There's a very similar theme in 1 Peter, so I would guess that the early Christians had a conversation about how to live out their dual citizenship in empire, and this was the wise consensus. When I was a kid, I heard Tony Campolo say, if Jesus wanted to save the world through politics, he would have come as Caesar and not as a baby in a manger. I think he means it is not God's primary strategy to change the world through political means. Basically, for the same reason as Paul says, there was not a way to do that in empire in Jesus' time, except to go to war with the empire. But I don't think this means God doesn't care about political systems, even though the word politics carries such negative feelings for a lot of us. But politics didn't start out being all the bad things politicians do in back rooms that become scandals in the news. Politics is the word that describes how a country organizes and looks after its citizens and make decisions, and a country with a positive vision is concerned with ways to get people to be good and get along and treat each other well. We're seeing a lot of this politics in action right now, both good and bad, as governments around the world mobilize to manage the pandemic. We can look around and see where government officials are doing a good job at educating and organizing citizens to keep each other safe, and the governments that are utterly failing at this. If effective politics is about taking care of people, then God's kingdom is all about that. That's why it is an alternative to empire. That's why God unleashes us into the world with love and kindness. He is organizing us to take care of our neighbors. Even though Paul lives in a political system where ordinary people do not have much power to make change, in a sense, Paul is acknowledging that a political system is necessary for the people of Rome to function. So Paul tells them to be a good Roman citizen and make the best of it. So if what Paul says is for Christians living in the Roman Empire, then we have to do some good thinking ourselves to see how it applies for us, because we have something that Paul didn't really have. We live in a democracy, and at least on paper, we each have a vote and we have a voice. And while in Paul's time, a good citizen is someone who keeps his head down and minds his own business when it comes to the way empire does things, in our time and place, we have a very different idea of how to be a good citizen. For us here, our society expects us to care about what goes on in society because it's a group effort. We are to say something if we see something, like injustices and things that don't work well, especially for people with less power and influence, and when they're bullied. And we're to find ways to pitch in and affect change, and we're to vote and keep an eye on our government. So I don't think Paul is telling us to forfeit our democratic voice because he doesn't know about democracy. So we are going to have to do our own thinking about how to use our democratic voice as a Christian. Historically, there have been several ways that Christians use their voice in society. Let's call number one the hostile takeover. Insert Christians into every level of government to seize power, change all the laws, and force Christian values down people's throat, whether they like it or not. This was like when the Catholic Church was its own empire, and the result wasn't great. Because as usual, power tends to magnify the damage broken humans can do in the world, even Christians. This was the time when the church ends up solving kingdom problems with the empire's way. They did forceful things because they had power. And today, people who think Christians are hypocrites continue to point at atrocious things done by the church during that time, like the Crusades, as proof that religion is bad for the world. So perhaps we may reflect on that bit of history to remind us that God's mission for us is not to maneuver Canada into looking and acting like a Christian country. People don't become God's children just because they act like it. God's mission for us is to love the Canadian people with God's love and see if they too might want to become citizens of his kingdom through a real relationship with Jesus. Those are two very different objectives. At the other end of the spectrum is the second way to use a voice, which is to not use it. It's like the Amish people. They separate from society, move into the hills, and have nothing to do with the world. The problem is, we can't love and bless people if we don't have a relationship with people. Jesus doesn't tell his disciples to separate from the world. He tells them to live in the world, but be cautious about who is influencing whom. So during the Reformation 500 years ago, there were a couple of new ways to be dual citizens while living in the world. Some Christians saw themselves as ambassadors for cultural exchange, where they would bring Christian values into the secular world, and they would also bring some good things from the secular world back into their Christian homes. Some other Christians were less friendly and more cautious, and they saw the two worlds in conflict. So they were more careful about what they let in and how friendly they wanted to get with the non-Christian world. More recently, there's been a new attitude about finding ways to do good together, that Christians try to focus on the overlap in the good vision that the world and God's kingdom both want for people. And we can work together to make a better world for everybody in partnership. For example, in the last civic election, the Vancouver Sun identified the main issues for people were housing, transportation, poverty, environment, and economy. So if we think those things make life better for people living here, regardless of whether they are Christian or not, then we can certainly lend our voice to others in support of improvements in these areas, so life is better for everybody. So we kill two birds with one stone, so to speak. We are being good citizens, and we're also loving and blessing people as God tells us to, even with our voice and vote. And that's how I voted. Now, I'm not telling you to do this. You have to do your own thinking about what you want to do. But like you probably, I find a number of candidates and choices involved in the civic election overwhelming. I didn't really know where to start. And in the end, I decided that instead of just thinking about what's good for me and my family and for Christians, I decided to think about what's good for everybody, especially the people who are less well off. And I decided to vote for the persons whom I thought might do the most good for those who most need help. So that worked for me, and that is my approach now for the moment. Not all of us are cut out to run for office. I certainly am not. Politicians are required to wade into swampy areas to get things done that many of us would find challenging. And when a Christian does get elected, I think they need to, in good faith, represent all the people in their riding, not just the people they're sympathetic with. And that means at any time, at least half the people will be mad at him or her, and some of us just don't have skin thick enough for that. But that's the job. And because Christians are dual citizens, God doesn't tell us to just love Christians. He tells us to love also our fellow countrymen and women. But even if we don't run for office, we still have a vote and a voice. And I think we can use our vote to do good for as many people as possible, not just for our own self-interests. The writer Philip Yancey wrote a book about Christians and politics, and he writes this. Quote, "Democracy requires us to recognize others' rights, even when we fundamentally disagree with them. It requires a civility in which I respect a person's ultimate worth and seek to persuade, not to coerce. For this reason, modern democracy grew out of Christian soil. We must exercise the skill of ethical surgeons in deciding which moral principles apply to society at large and how best to apply them." Unquote. I think the thing we want to remember is that as Christians, we're all spokespersons for God and His kingdom. Paul's encouragement to the Roman Christians to be good citizens still applied to us, because being written up in the papers for running a Ponzi scheme is not going to do much for our reputation in the world, nor our witness for God. But that doesn't mean we have to be perfect people. Because God is in the business of redeeming broken and flawed people to make something good in the world. Our lives testify to what God can do with ordinary, messy, broken people like us. However, when we use our democratic voice or get into politics, we do need to try to sound like Jesus. Gracious, respectful, loving, and kind. At the end of the day, God is not depending on us to figure out how to save the world in headlining ways. That's His job. He simply asks us to love people and do what's in front of us to help make a bit of difference so He can add that bit of good that we do to the big thing He's weaving to make a better world for everyone. There's a lawyer in the States named Bob Goff, G-O-F-F. A giant of a man who seems to be always laughing. He wrote a book called Love Does, and I do recommend the book. But the way he lives his dual citizenship is that he seems to spend a lot of time thinking up ways to make life better for people, one at a time. Like one Thanksgiving, he decided to give some kids a parade just up and down his street, and somehow that has become an annual tradition where all the neighbors would get in on it. One year, he heard about the struggles of poor children in Uganda, and he decided to start a charity to try and build a school there. That charity is called Love Does. And one day he got a call from the Uganda government asking if he would be their consul. He thought they were looking for a lawyer. It turns out they had heard about his work with the children, and they were asking him to represent their country at the UN. And at the UN, he finds himself getting to meet some world leaders, some that don't get along with each other. So he decided to informally invite these rivals to spend a weekend at his cabin, which he owns on one of our islands here. He wanted to bless them with a relaxing retreat, but he also wanted to create an opportunity for friendship that might lead to something good in the world. He didn't set out to do all that. He just did what was in front of him to love somebody. And God took what he did and put it into play in the bigger scheme of things. This is what his friend wrote in the foreword to Bob's book. Bob Goff has had a greater impact on my life than any person I've known. The reason Bob has impacted my life is because he loves me. Bob Goff loves people with a force that is natural, and by natural I mean nature, like a waterfall or wind or waves on the ocean. He loves effortlessly. I think Bob Goff knows God, and I think God's love flows through him. What do you do with a man who will get on a plane and fly around the world to attend the wedding of a new acquaintance? What do you do with a man who offices at Tom Sawyer Island at Disneyland because angry lawyers are less likely to yell at him there? And for that matter, what do you do with a lawyer whose business card simply reads helper? What do you do with a man who worked for 2 years to free a child from prison in Uganda, all because I met the kid and asked him to? How do you explain the fact that he lumbers pajama-clad into his garden every morning to find a rose for his sleeping wife? And then there's the old lady who ran into his Jeep, sending his body flying into the street, to whom he also sent flowers. There are the DC diplomats, the new acquaintances to whom Daly sent pizza for a week, the Ugandan judiciary that he took to Disneyland, and the refugee camp outside Gulu, where he dug wells and delivered pounds and pounds of clothes. I don't know how to explain Bob's love except to say it is utterly and delightfully devastating. Bob has given me a vision for what can happen in a person's life when they're devoted to giving it away. We don't like to put hands and feet on love. When love is a theory, it's safe, it's free of risk. But love in the brain changes nothing. Where you and I may want love and feel love and say love, Bob reminds us that love does things. It writes a letter, gets on a plane, it orders pizza and jumps in a lake. It hugs and prays and cries and sings. Much of what we've come to know and believe about love doesn't ring true once you know this man whose love does. Unquote. One day I hope there will be a few people on the planet who thinks this of me, not because I want people to think I'm a great guy, but so that I know I have tried to represent God well. But I'm not Bob. We're different people. We have different personalities. So I have to find my own way to do the same thing, just as you have to find your own way to do the same thing. My first car was a 5-year-old Honda Civic I found on a lot on Main Street. The dealership there is famous for how every month the salesperson with the lowest sales gets fired. It's a very harsh way to keep staff motivated. So the man who sold me the car, someone originally from Vietnam and friends with the family and church, he said everyone in that dealership tried to keep their job by making as much money as possible on every single sale. But him, he had a different strategy. He gives good deals. So that satisfied customers would refer more customers, and his little sales add up to a big number at the end of the month. He was many times salesman of the month, and the other people can't understand how he does it. See, he holds up the paperwork for my car. I only make $50 from this car. But if you tell your friends about me, then I'm happy. And to make sure he leaves a good impression on me, he actually spent an hour with me to teach me how to drive stick because I didn't know how to. It was a really rough test drive. But he said if I buy the car, he would teach me how to drive it, and he did exactly that. And I did send a few friends to him over the years. He's probably not with us anymore. He didn't make the Order of Canada, but he really blessed me. And that's what mattered to me. I think it's the idea of using what we have to be faithful in little things. A preacher tweeted recently, "Culture is not to be conquered or converted, but incarnated, inhabited, and impregnated with the seeds of the gospel." I think that is Jesus. He didn't come to conquer or even to convert by force. He incarnated, inhabited, and impregnated the world with seeds of the gospel in people like us. Even though Paul doesn't know what democracy is, he tells the Christians in his time to go love people, both in and outside the church, and God used them to change the world. I think our mission is still the same. We are to use what we have, including our democratic voice and vote, to love people. And if we do, then perhaps we will see how God will use what we do to change the world. This is 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 13 to 17 in the Message. Make the master proud of you by being good citizens. Respect the authorities, whatever their level. They are God's emissaries for keeping order. It is God's will that by doing good, you might cure the ignorance of the fools who think you are a danger to society. Exercise your freedom by serving God, not by breaking the rules. Treat everyone you meet with dignity. Love your spiritual family. Revere God. Respect the government. Amen.